squashed them.
Nah, I'm good.
You were right, Shelley said, about Kent. He deserved it. He brought it down on himself. Something unshackled in Ephraim's chest. He didn't hate Kent. It was a question of fairness, was all. You pay what you owe.
Max will understand, Shelley said softly. Even Newton. Before long, they'll see how right you were.
There was something oddly narcotic about Shelley's monotone drawl. Ephraim felt sluggish and just a bit queasy, that happy sick feeling he got in his belly after riding the tilt-a-whirl at the Montague Fair.
Come, Shelley patted the dirt. Sit.
It seemed less a request, more a subtle directive. Ephraim sat. Shelley's body kicked off ambient warmth, moist and weirdly salty, like the air wafting from the mouth of a volcanic sea cave. He slid one pale, whip-like arm over Ephraim's shoulder, an oily, frictionless, hairless appendage slipping across, smooth and dense, like a heavy rubber hose. His fingers thrummed on Ephraim's bare flesh. Ephraim wanted to brush them away, their tacky warmth making him mildly revolted, but that narcotic sluggishness prevented him from doing so. Shelley's arm constricted just a little. He was stronger than he looked, pulling Ephraim close.
You're in charge now, Eph. Isn't that just awesome? That's how it should have been all along, isn't it?
I don't really care about that. Shelley smiled, a knowing expression.
Sure you don't.
I don't, sincerely. Rage crept up Ephraim's throat, burning like bile.
Shut your fucking mouth, Shell.
Shelley's smile persisted, the edgeless grin of a moron. His teeth were tiny, Ephraim had never noticed before. Like niblick corn, bands of yellow crust rimmed each tooth. Did Shelley ever brush his teeth? Did something like Shelley even think about stuff like that?
Something like Shelley? Ephraim thought. Someone, I mean. Someone.
Relax, Eve. I'm on your side.
Where the hell were Max and Newt?
Ephraim wished like hell they were here now. Anything was better than being cooped up.
Trapped?
In this dank cellar was Shelley. Lightning flashed, igniting the slit where the cellar doors met in camera flash incandescence. Thunder boomed with such force that it seemed to bulge the planks overhead, rattling Ephraim's heart in its fragile cage of bone.
Jesus, Eph.
Shelley was staring at Ephraim, at his hands.
What?
Shelley's arm slid off Ephraim's shoulder. He leaned away, swallowing hard, his eyes riveted on Ephraim's hands, his torn, bloody hands.
What the hell are you looking at, Shell?
Nothing. It's...
No, it's nothing.
Ephraim's arms shot out, snatching Shelley's collar. Shelley issued a mewling noise of disgust, heels digging into the dirt as he propelled himself away. He knocked the candle over, snuffing it.
Your fingernails, he said, a blubbery, spittle-flecked shriek. I think I saw something moving under your fingernails, Eph.
Ephraim's hand fell away from Shelley's collar, his fingers knitting into a ball under his trembling chin. The darkness closed in, strangling, suffocating, squeezing the air from his lungs. The skin under his fingernails, skin he'd never even considered as a discrete part of his body, buzzed at a hellish new frequency.
What did you see?
Something, was all Shelley would say.
Something.
Next, fists were pounding on the cellar doors.
Eph, open up, man!
Ephraim tried to stand. He couldn't. The strength had fled his body. He curled into a ball, knees drawn tight to his stomach.
Eph!
Shelley hesitated for a long moment before mounting the cellar steps. Newt and Max came down, wind-blown and dripping wet. Ephraim's heart swelled at the sight.
You okay? Max said.
Yes, Ephraim thought, shivering with cold anger. It's nothing. Not a goddamn thing at all. Fucking Shell. I'll kill him. It was nothing, Eth, Shell said, grinning greasily in the dark. I was wrong, probably.
Newt said, wrong about what?
Nothing, Eth shouted, and in the next instant there came a ripping and rending crash as the big oak cracked almost directly above them, the splintering mash of wood as the tree crashed through the cabin roof. Boom! The air inside the cellar seemed to condense and turn to cold lead in the boys' lungs. The tree struck the floor with a terrible impact and bounced once. The cellar roof splintered. Shafts of cold light streamed through the shattered slats. Next it bulged down threateningly.
Oh, God, Max said. The Scoutmaster.
Uncertainty flickered on the boys' faces. As the rain and wind hit a momentary lull, they could hear Kent outside at the cellar doors.
Please! Please!
He begged, the words coming out in hysterical yelps. He scratched on the doors like a dog pleading to come inside on a cold night. Ephraim caught Max's eye, holding it. No words were spoken. Finally, Ephraim bowed his head, blew at the hanging fringe of his hair, and tromped determinedly up the steps. The fear in his heart morphed into something else, at least temporarily, a breed of unflexing resolve. It seemed the best, perhaps only way to keep a lid on his terror. He unlatched the door and threw it open. Rain arrowed through the entryway, lightning lit the planes of Kent's twitching, horrible face.
Get in, Ephraim said, but you have to sit away from us. I'm sorry.
Kent nodded pathetically and dragged himself to the corner with the boat tarp, pulling it over him. Max caught Ephraim looking at Kent's wounds, then at his own split knuckles. It wasn't hard to guess what he was thinking. From the sworn testimony of Nathan Erickson, given before the Federal Investigatory Board in connection with the events occurring on Falstaff Island, Prince Edward Island. Question. Let's clarify for the record just what we're talking about. You were working on a diet supplement? Answer. It was to be a pill. That's the grail, right? A pill you can pop before bed? A little white pill. That was the idea. Question. And this pill would be made of? Answer. Compressed dextrose. You know those candy hearts you get on Valentine's Day? Same stuff. Basically, it's sugar pressed into a mold using pneumatic pressure. Question. You mean a placebo? Answer. Sugar pills are the classic test of the placebo effect, but no, these were fully loaded. Question. Why a sugar pill, then? Answer. Any delivery system would work. Why not go with something sweet? Fact is, the mutagenic strain of the hydatid worm developed by Dr. Edgerton was incredibly hardy. They could have been packed into a dextrose pill and shot into space. If a creature with a human-like digestive system were to find those pills floating out in space 1,000 years later and swallow them, those worms would hatch and thrive. Nothing beats a worm in terms of survivability. Question. So these worms were packed into a candy pill? Answer. The eggs were freeze-dried. Like the sea monkeys kids used to buy in the back pages of old G.I. Joe comics, the dormant state eggs would become larvae and later full-stage hydatids. Question. And the expectation was that people would be desperate enough to consume these pills to lose weight? That was what Dr. Edgerton and his silent partner slash bankroller pharmacy concern expected? Answer. People are already desperate enough. You've never heard of the tapeworm diet? You've got people eating tainted beef to give themselves worms. It's not nearly as uncommon as you'd think. It's illegal in North America, sure, but Mexican diet clinics are doing a brisk business. Question. What made your method a better option? Answer. A beef tapeworm is a great diet aid if it stays in your gut. Problem is, tapeworms are wanderers. They go on walkabout inside your body. They'll swim out of your intestines or needle through your intestinal wall and insist in your liver or brain or eyes or spinal cord. An insisted worm in your brain shows up the same as a tumor on a CAT scan. It can do the same level of damage, too. But the modified hydatid we were working on would be corralled in the host's intestines, like those electric fences cattle ranchers use to keep their cows in their fields.
Dr. Edgerton was working on reconstructing the worm's basic DNA sequence so that it would die as soon as it perforated the intestinal wall. It was a matter of weakening its natural immunities, making it more susceptible to white blood cell attack. White blood plasma would eat through Dr. Edgerton's worms like acid. Anyway, that was the idea. Question. And when a person reaches his target weight? Answer. An oral antibiotic flushes out the worm colony in a matter of days. The two-pill solution, we'd bill it. One pill to give you worms, the other to flush them out. Question. And in between? Answer. You'd lose those troublesome pounds. Question. But the worm you helped Dr. Edgerton develop didn't act according to plan, did it? Answer. I'd say that is somewhat of an understatement.
Chapter 23. In time, the wind died down. The storm blew out to the northern sea. Water dripped all around them. It seemed terribly loud, each drop producing a watery echo. The boys huddled, shivering and soaked in the cellar, all except Kent, who sat in isolation under the tarp.
We ought to check on the scoutmaster, Newton said.
Ephraim nodded.
Kent, you stay here.
Kent's face was wan and ghoulish above the burlap. It looked like the wooden face of Zoltar, that mechanical sideshow oracle at the Cavendish County Fair. 25 cents to know your future. Things were stuck in his braces, too.
Insect parts?
Yes. Thoraxes and legs and antennae bristled from his mouth metal. He was gnawing on the moldy tarp, working the frayed edge like an old man gumming a carrot. A faraway look in his eyes. He could have been contemplating a lovely sunset.
Okay, he said. I kind of like it down here anyway.
You okay, Kay? Newton asked, repulsion lying heavy in his gorge.
Sure, a death's head grin. Never better.
A collective unease enveloped the boys, even Shelley. How long had it been?
Less than 12 hours.
Half a day ago, Kent Jenks had been one of them, the biggest and strongest of them all, the boy everyone in North Point forecasted great things for. Now here he was, curled in a cellar, insects gummed in his teeth, gnawing mindlessly on a tarp. Reduced and squandered in some nasty, terrifying, unquantifiable way. Whatever was wrong with him, this sickness, it was rampaging. Barnstorming through his body, devouring him. Newton sensed this, that Kent was being eaten from the inside out, his flesh loosening by degrees, the meat flensed from his bones as his body shrunk inside his skin until... until what? This sickness cared nothing for Kent, for the man he could have become, for the bright future that seemed so assured. It was coring him out, ruining him in unfixable ways. They left him down there. Ephraim shut the doors and jammed a stick between the handles so Kent couldn't escape. The island was still in the passing of the storm. As they'd heard from the cellar, the huge oak, one of only 5 or 6 truly big trees on Falstaff Island, had snapped, falling upon the cabin's interlaced log walls. The spot where it had broken looked like the butt of a trick cigar, splinters of wood stuck out of the trunk at crazy angles, perfuming the air with sap. They inhaled the peculiar scent of the earth after a storm while surveying the cabin. The roof was cleaved in half, sagging inward like a huge toothless mouth. The door hung off its shattered hinges. Ephraim hauled it open. His gaze fell to scrutinize his fingernails. He shot a look at Shelley, who caught his eyes and held them evenly.
Careful as we go inside, Ephraim said, sounding very much like Kent. Cover your mouths like before.
The roof had collapsed in a solid flap that resembled a wave set to break. The boys walked through a corridor of shadow created by the fallen roof and found Scoutmaster Tim in the splintered remains of the closet. The tree had snapped the 2x4s and pancaked the closet's plywood walls. The trunk had landed on his head and shoulders.
Tim, Newton said in a small, disbelieving voice, are you...
The final word, okay, died on his lips. Scoutmaster Tim was definitely not okay. The finality of the situation assaulted Newton. It was in the way the tree trunk sat flush with the floor. It was in the crushed eggshell of the scoutmaster's skull, which was visible, barely but hideously visible, beneath the bark. It was in the jagged purple lines that raced all over his flesh. The pressure had bulged and ruptured his vesicles. His skin looked like some gruesome jigsaw puzzle. It was in the sweet smell that rose off his body and the darker undernote of death. A somehow rusty smell, Newton thought, like the smell that came off a seized engine block at the dump. It was in the boot that had fallen off his foot, more like ejected off when the tree came crashing down, causing his legs to spike upward in one spastic motion, flinging his boot away. It was in the pale knob of his toe poking through the woolen sock. It was in the cricket that rested in the split V of his open shirt collar, which had just then begun to rub its legs together to produce a high, humming song. "He looks like the witch in The Wizard of Oz," Shelley said. "The one the house landed on, not the one that melted."
"Shut the fuck up, Shell," Ephraim said hoarsely.
Newton's heart was a wounded bird flapping inside his chest. He wanted to scream, but the sound was locked up under his lungs.
"What should we do?" he said. "Is he really?"
He found it impossible to say. Dead. The word itself was somehow unapproachable. He knelt and touched Scoutmaster Tim's hand. The flesh was cold and dank like a rock in a fast-running river.
"It's okay, Newt," Ephraim said. "It must have been fast, you know? I don't think he even felt it."
Newton spoke with his head down.
"You think so?"
Max sincerely hoped it was so. He felt sick. His scoutmaster, the adult he'd known longer than anyone else besides his own parents, had died in a closet. The one person with the best ideas for getting them off the island was gone, and he'd left 5 dumb, piss-scared kids behind.
"Should we bury him?" Ephraim said. Before any of them had a chance to respond, Scoutmaster Tim's stomach began to move.
At first it was barely visible. It seemed as if weak fingers were pawing at it from the inside. Max watched, his mouth unhinged. It was sickeningly mesmerizing.
"What?"
Ephraim breathed.
"Is that?"
A fragile white tube broke the surface of the skin an inch above the scoutmaster's navel. It pushed through insistently, twisting around as if tasting the air. It was followed quickly by another and another. Soon there were 7 or 8. It looked like the legs of an albino spider struggling to escape its spider hole. Each tube was slightly pebbled. They seemed to be studded with something. Max squinted closer. They were... oh God, they were mouths. Little mouths like the ones on a sucker fish. The scoutmaster's stomach split soundlessly like saran wrap, groin to ribcage. Hundreds of worms came boiling out, all much smaller versions of the single massive abomination that had come out of the other man, the stranger. Some were the thickness of butcher's twine, but most were frail and wispy, as insubstantial as the clipped threads of a spider web. They twisted and roiled and spilled down the scoutmaster's papery flesh, his skin empty of blood and nutrients, just a soft white covering like dry fat back. Max noticed that the worms didn't appear to be singular entities. Rather, they were twisted together, a pulpy white ball radiating dozens or hundreds. It was as if something had gathered them up and tied them all into a bulging knot, like that ball they saw yesterday on the rocks, a knot of fucking snakes. These spiky worm balls tumbled over one another, squirming and shucking. A horrible low hissing noise emanated from the scoutmaster's chest cavity.
"No," Newt said, his head snapping side to side. "No, no, no, no."
The hissing noise stopped. Slowly, achingly, the worms stretched as a single unit, a cooperative hive mind, toward the sound of Newton's voice. "Jesus," said Ephraim. Then the worms swung in his direction. Some of them swelled menacingly, a small bead crowning at their tips. There came a series of dim popgun percussions. Delicate strands wafted through the air, sunlight falling along their ghostly, wavering contours. Ephraim stepped back. He swatted at the strands with a helpless look on his face. He stared at his knuckles, which were broken open and still weeping slug trails of blood from his fight with Kent. Max knew Ephraim so well that he could almost see the crazed thought forming in the other boy's head. "They can get inside of me through there. These wounds are basically wide-open doors in my body." Through an aperture in the cleaved roof, Max spotted a slit of perfectly blue sky, that scintillating blue that comes on the heels of a bad storm, and below a scrim of gray marking the mainland. His parents would be there. Why hadn't they come yet? His folks and Newt's and Eve's and Kent's and Shelley's too. Fuck old man Waters. If he couldn't get his ancient ass in gear, why wouldn't their folks show up? Kent's dad could use the police patrol boat. Special dispensation, right? An emergency. But no, they'd left their kids alone on this killing floor of an island. Two men were dead already, and Kent was bad off. Death warmed over, as Max's mom would say. Except for Kent, death might come as a relief. A shudder fled down Max's spine. The very thought of Kent, dead, his body invaded by these things. Devourer versus Conqueror Worms. The Dual Nature of the Modified Hydatid. Excerpt from a paper given by Dr. Cynthia Preston, MD, Microbiology and Immunology at the 27th International Papillomavirus and Clinical Workshop at the University of Boston, Massachusetts. The evidence found in Dr. Edgerton's laboratory is breathtaking, both in the groundbreaking nature of what he was able to accomplish and in the savage expediency of his methods. Edgerton was viewed by his contemporaries as pathologically secretive. Conversations with him, according to the few who spent time in his presence, were narrowly focused on his work or the work of his rivals. Edgerton was an only child. His parents passed away in an automobile accident while he was attending graduate school. By all outward signs, he lived for his work. His fellow researchers remember him as a hardliner known to play fast and loose with scientific ethics. One oft-reported incident, especially telling in light of the events at Falstaff Island, recounts an evening when Edgerton was discovered by campus police at his alma mater. He'd snuck into a lab using a stolen passkey and was discovered in the process of destroying the work of his closest rival, a senior by the name of Edward Truskins. Truskins had been working on a skin graft technique involving lab mice. Edgerton was caught red-handed, as they say, with the syringe of strychnine. Despite this infraction and the chilling mindset it signaled, he was soon pursuing his work at another institute. He was simply too talented. He could also be convincingly sincere when circumstances compelled it. There are those who say the best scientists occupy that dangerous headspace teetering at the edge of madness. By this definition, Dr. Edgerton was most certainly a world-class scientist. Edgerton's work with the hydatid worm rivaled what Dr. Jonas Salk did for immunology in the 1950s, not in terms of its immediate social benefit. All Edgerton actually created was the most adaptable and survivable parasite known to mankind. But in his successful genetic manipulation of this planet's simplest life form, he took a simple planarian worm and unlocked its genetic code. In doing so, he allowed it to modify its basic anatomic and gastric substructure in ways heretofore thought impossible for any life form. He enabled the hydatid worm to adapt to its environment on the fly. His stated aim was to rob the worm of its natural defenses in the interest of quarantining it within its host. What he accomplished was the exact opposite. He opened a genetic Pandora's box. When his hydatid was confronted with a cliff, it grew wings. Confronted with an unbridgeable sea, it grew gills. Its adaptability enabled it to mutate in a dizzying variety of ways,
Just like snowflakes, no two of Dr. Edgerton's hydatids were exactly alike. His worms broke down into two broad categories. In the interests of distinction, let's call them devourer worms and conqueror worms. Some species of tapeworm will enter into a parasitic symbiosis with their hosts. They can live in the host for years, eating only enough to survive. But even unmutated hydatids do not behave this way. Their genetic imperative is to populate and eventually overrun their hosts, overtaxing their immunodeficiency systems and essentially starving them to death. This rarely happens. Even the worst hydatid infestation can be flushed out with proper medication. But the video footage recovered from the Edgerton lab indicates that the modified hydatid is both extremely hardy and extremely aggressive. It spawns far faster, devours far more, and grows far larger. As such, it is the equivalent of a kamikaze pilot. Its appetite quickens its own extinction cycle. The mutated devourer hydatid does two things, eats and reproduces. After the infestation reaches critical mass, it begins to consume the living tissues of its host. This behavior distinguishes it from the common hydatid, which is incapable of digesting anything beyond waste matter. A devourer will consume protein, fat, muscle tissue, even bone marrow, and the vitreous jelly of a host's eyes. This accounts for much of the wasting effect on its host. They come to look like long-time starvation victims in a matter of hours. The devastation is intensified by the fact that every molecule of nourishment a devourer consumes serves a single purpose: to make more of itself. A devourer eats and lays eggs. It is not uncommon for a devourer colony to reach a critical state after an incubation period of only a few hours. It is simply impossible for a host to take in enough nourishment to satisfy a devourer colony. Whatever the host eats produces more creatures seeking more nourishment. Chapter 24. Kent was dreaming. He was on the ocean with his father. Night was coming on. The eerie smoothness of the water, not a wave or ripple, was what made Kent realize that he was dreaming. Kent was thinking about a girl in his class, Anna Uniac. Anna was pretty and trim, and he was sure his father would approve. He often looked at Anna out of the corner of his eye. She sat one seat ahead and to the left of him at school. The light would fall through the classroom window and pick up the fine downy hairs on her cheeks. It looked like peach fuzz, Kent thought. He could eat Anna's skin just like that, just like a peach. The sky was strung with strange clouds, a dull crimson and hanging very low, bleeding into the setting sun. Kent thought that he could see shapes in them, sinuous squirmings as if the clouds were coming apart in the face of the ocean wind or giving birth to multiples or something else he could put no name to. His father wore his police uniform. His badge winked in the guttering embers of the day's light. His father's wrists projecting from his sleeves were wasted-looking, and his fingers too skeletal. "It'll be a long night," he said, "and goddamn, I'm hungry." A flock of birds, not the ever-present gulls, but jet-black, arrow-eyed ravens, flew overhead, shadowing their boat. Kent could hear their tortured cries and see their rotted beaks. Some kind of white, cindery dust was drifting down from beneath their wings. It fell through the air in little white ribbons, just like in a ticker tape parade. Fear stole into Kent's heart. He wished he wasn't so scared. His father had taught him that fear was a useless emotion. "Fear is just weakness exiting the body," he'd said to Kent on many occasions. But there was something wrong with the whole scene. The menacing shapes lurking within the clouds, the white things drifting down, and his father. His father. The police uniform hung off his body. He lurched toward Kent with his arms outstretched, stick arms that wouldn't have looked out of place on a concentration camp prisoner, his fingers just clattering bone. His face was all cheekbones and bulging brow and parchment-thin skin stretched to the point of tearing. A long night, this starved apparition screamed at him. A long and hungry night. Yummy, yum, yum. His father reached for Kent, bony hands clawing round his shoulders, digging in, piercing the skin. Jeff Jenks leaned in, and his skin now came apart. Rifts appeared in the fabric of his face, fine lines like cracks in bone china, and then those rifts all met and began to wriggle, and suddenly Kent was staring into a face made up of hundreds of white, pulsating tubes. Nobody loves me, his worm father sang sadly. Writhing alabaster worms dripped off his lips and into his mouth, thrashing contentedly on the Swiss-cheesed root of his tongue. Everybody hates me. I'm going to the garden to eat you. Kent toppled into the bottom of the boat with his father atop him. His father's face fell apart in sections. The abominations detached and squirmed down his collar, pattering onto Kent's upturned face like warm raindrops. They found his mouth and nose and ears and eyes, infiltrating them with greedy abandon. This is only fear entering the body, his father said. Newton was the one who suggested they make a list. His own survival instincts told him this was the wisest plan. When the world was crumbling around your ears, your best bet was to set yourself a few simple tasks to focus your attention on. While you were working on those tasks, your mind had a chance to cope with the situation. If you could just get past the initial shock, the shock of death and of sudden isolation, then maybe a better plan would come to you later. They stood down at the shore now, Ephraim, Max, Shelley, and Newton. Three things, Newt said. First, find some food. Second, medicine for Kent. Why? Shelley said. He's just going to end up like Tim. Newton glanced up sharply. Shut up, Shell. Shut up and go away. Walk into the ocean and just sink. We don't know that. We don't know that at all. Shelley only smiled, sadly, poisonously, impossible to tell, and wandered down to the shoreline. That's right, Newton thought. Just keep walking, jerkoid. Third, Newton went on, we either make a raft or oars for the boat we already have. Ephraim doubled over, clutching his knees, and vomited on the rocks. His body vibrated like a hard-struck tuning fork. He stayed that way for a while, breathing heavily, before straightening up and wiping his lips. I don't know. He stared at the other boys. I don't know what to do now. His gaze fell to his knuckles. He rubbed them with his fingers and spread blood down to his wrist. There was something obsessive about the way he did it. Newton said, It's okay. It's not okay, said Ephraim. The scoutmaster's dead. Oh my God, his belly split open and a bunch of worms fell out. Worms! How the hell did they get there? Max said, We have to stay away from the cabin. Do what Newt said. Get some food, make a raft or something, find a way back home. Shelley called from the beachhead. You sure we'll be able to get back home? He was crouched by the shore, stirring the water with a stick. He pushed the tip of it against the fat body of a sea slug. He exerted slow pressure until the slug's body burst like a snot-filled bath bead. The boys hadn't seen what he'd done. Did it matter anyway? Part of him, a growing part, wanted to shed the mask that shielded his underface. The possibility put a warm lump in his belly. What are you talking about, Shell? Ephraim said. He pointed across the water at the squat shapes on the horizon. Those aren't trawlers. They aren't fishing boats. Those are ships, like military stuff. So? So think about it, Eve, he said. That guy who showed up the other night, what was that thing that came out of him? And then Scoutmaster? And then Kent? Whatever it is, it's spreading, right? That means it's a disease, something that hops from person to person. He cocked his head at Ephraim, who kept rubbing his knuckles against the coarse weave of his pants. It gets inside of you somehow and starts doing what it does, I guess. Ephraim's hands clenched into fists. Blood was streaked down his pants. What are you saying, Shell?
I'm saying maybe they won't let us leave. Even if we build a raft, they'll keep us right here because we're contagious. We're contaminated.
Shut up, Max said. That's stupid bullshit. Nobody's going to keep a bunch of kids on an island, Shell. Our folks wouldn't let it happen. They're adults. Adults don't do stuff like that.
As his words echoed into silence, Max realized that he'd held the exact opposite viewpoint only minutes ago inside the cabin. His mind wasn't centered anymore. It spun on confused, worrisome tangents.
Can you explain those ships? Ephraim asked Max, hopefully.
They could be army ships. All I'm saying is they're not going to stop us from going home.
Then why aren't they coming to get us? Shelley said.
Max had no answer for that.
Newton said, they could have a million reasons for staying away. If it's something contagious, maybe they have a cure. Then they'll be here quick as quick. But Max is right. They're adults. If they're making us wait, I'm sure there's a good reason. Until then, we have to make do. That shouldn't be so hard, should it? We're scouts, aren't we?
So what are we going to eat? Max said.
Newton said, there's berries and fungi. We should be able to catch something, don't you think? Scoutmaster showed us how to string a foot trap, and there's rope in the cabin.
Are you going to get that rope? Shelley asked.
If I have to, Newton told him evenly.
Ephraim said, what about Kent, if he's sick?
If he is sick, Shelley said.
If you don't shut up, I'm going to put your head through a tree, Ephraim said.
Save your energy, Eve, Shelley said in a voice gone silky soft.
Kent needs to throw it all up, Eaton said. That's the best way to get what's inside of him out. There are plants that can do that pretty safely. It's in my field book, which is still in the cabin, so I'd better...
A boat motor kicked up beyond the spit of headland that projected from the southern tip of the island. The boys could just barely make out a boat streaking toward them.
Hey, check it out. That's Mr. Walmack's cigarette boat, Ephraim said.
Calvin Walmack was one of the town's few summer people. He showed up every June with a mahogany tan, bleached white teeth, and his shrill wife, Tippy. Mr. Walmack owned a vintage cigarette boat that was moored down at the jetty. The Ferrari of boats, Max's father called it. Pretty much just a huge motor strapped to strips of polished teak. Mr. Walmack's boat hammered over the water, hitting the waves and skipping dangerously. It looked to be on the verge of hydroplaning. Two other boats were in pursuit, stockier and painted a dusty black. Gun turrets were mounted on their bows. The cigarette boat skiffed off a big wave and came down with a smack. The engine cut out. A thin ribbon of smoke coiled up to smudge the sky. Newton could see two men in the boat, but they were too far off for him to make out faces. They were waving their arms. The pursuing vessels cut around the cigarette boat in a scissoring move. Men moved swiftly about on deck. Ephraim thought he saw the sun glinting down their arms, glinting off the weapons they were carrying. The boats bobbed on the surf. The boys watched with their hands canopying their eyes. The black boats returned the way they had come. The cigarette boat remained afloat but looked empty. When the black boats were well clear, a small explosion rocked Mr. Walmack's boat. A gout of flame shot up from the engine. A sound like a shotgun blast trailed across the sea.
What the hell?
Ephraim's face settled into an expression between bafflement and fear.
What just happened right now?
Nobody had an answer. Not for what happened to Mr. Walmack or his boat, or for anything that had happened since that strange man staggered out of the sea two nights ago. Nothing made sense anymore. Everything existed beyond logic. The cigarette boat sank and was gone in a matter of seconds. Chapter 25. Before they entered the woods, Newton stepped inside the cabin. He needed his field book and the rope. His heart was beating like a tom-tom. Fat beads of sweat popped along his brow before he even walked through the shattered doorframe.
Don't do this, his mother's voice chimed in his head. Please, this is so very dangerous, Newt. Newton's mom had always been protective of her only son. Elizabeth Thornton was crowned Miss Prince Edward Island the day after she'd fallen pregnant with Newton. Fallen pregnant was a common phrase on the island, as if local women were constantly toppling off things, stools, ladders, cliffs, and getting knocked up on the way down. The man who'd done it was a contest stylist, a fey grifter who mentored unwitting contestants. For a fee, he'd teach them to Vaseline their teeth to a pearly shine or strap packing tape around their breasts to give the proper uplift. Such men trailed along the pageant circuit like gulls following in the wake of a crab trawler picking up scraps. This particular stylist put a bun in Elizabeth's oven the night before the Charlottetown Spud Fest. He was gone the next day, no different from the itinerant potato pickers who descend on the island like locusts in the fall, only to blow back to the mainland on the first winter wind. Newton never asked after his father. He and his mother made a tiny, perfect circle, and he was happy within its circumference. And as for those skills a father might have taught, well, there was Scoutmaster Tim, who struck Newt as a far better surrogate dad than a contest stylist could ever be. Complications during the delivery led to severe scarring of her uterine walls. Newton would be the only child Elizabeth would ever have. "Some people around here have lots of kids," she'd tell her son. "It's like they're trying to get it just right, the perfect child. Well, I got that right off the bat. I guess this was God's subtle way of telling me I didn't have to try anymore. I can always find another man, but I'll never be able to find another son." Oh, hell, and could Elizabeth find another man? All she'd have to do was step outside and whistle. They'd come running from all directions with flowers and heart-shaped boxes of chocolate clasped in their calloused hands. Elizabeth Thornton was a pure stunner. Another common phrase, island women are like Christmas trees, nobody wants them after the 25th, didn't apply to her. Her face had taken on a luminous, haunted quality as she'd aged. It only intensified her beauty. She had no shortage of suitors, despite being saddled with a teenager, even one as oddball as Newton. But she resisted all advances and lived alone with her son in a small house on the edge of town. She was happy. Her son was happy. But Elizabeth was a perpetual worrywart. Much to Newt's chagrin, she wanted to drape him in bubble wrap before sending him out into the world. She didn't even approve of him being in Scouts, but it was the only social outlet he had. The kids at school could be so cruel. The sons of lobstermen and potato farmers didn't understand her sensitive boy. At least Scouts was better than Newt spending his afternoons in the woods alone, cataloging ferns and tubers. "You be careful," she told Newton at the boat launch before he'd left for Falstaff. She kissed his forehead and mussed up his hair. "Don't eat any funny mushrooms or chase after things that might bite you." "Mom, please," Newton had said, mortified. Her voice was in his ear, even now, ever present, as he made his way through the storm-splintered cabin. "Newt, oh, Newt, my baby boy, this is not a good idea." What choice did he have? His books were in there. The rope, too. Without them, they might starve, and Kent might die just like the Scoutmaster had. For a fleeting instant, Newton had a very un-Newt-like fantasy. He pictured himself stepping into a throng of well-wishers, his fellow scouts sitting gratefully in Oliver McCanty's boat, which Newt had fixed and piloted back to the mainland. Next, the mayor would pin a badge on Newt's chest in a ceremony at town hall, Scoutmaster Tim's portrait in a gilt-edged frame, his mom waving from the crowd, Max and Ephraim safe and thankful, his friends now. Newt demurring when the mayor called him a true hero, saying only, "It was all due to my scout's training, sir." This silly, self-obsessed fantasy left him feeling a little embarrassed. The cabin roof bowed in a rotted arc to touch the floor, or nearly so. There was still a portion where it failed to reach, a jagged lip where the fungal-encrusted shingles didn't quite touch the floorboards. Newton knew that on the other side of that lip, maybe only a foot away, lay Scoutmaster Tim's body. And the last time he'd seen him, he'd been writhing with... Newton didn't want to think about it. But the first real threads of terror had now begun to squirm in his belly. An awful silence sat heavy within his chest, It was mirrored by the same awful silence on the other side of the roof where the scoutmaster lay. Or was it entirely? Newton was almost positive he could hear something.
Newton, oh my baby, get out of there, get out of there this instant.
He thought of Sherwood, his cousin, tall, stout-shouldered, sure, all roped in farm boy muscle, which made him think about Alex Markson, the boy he'd made up on Facebook, a fusion between Sherwood and himself. What would Alex Markson do? Newton wondered. He turned it into an acronym, WWAMD. So, WWAMD in this situation. Alex wouldn't be afraid. No, Alex would be afraid because Alex was most certainly a sane person with the correct instincts for self-preservation. But Alex would do whatever was needed. He'd do the right thing. How could the worm still be alive if their host was dead? Shouldn't be possible, right? Newton stared at the lip between the shingles and the floor. A fleeting band of light traced along its edge. Yes, there. He swore he saw movement. Tiny, wavering shadows flitted through the light. Then he heard the noises like cockroaches scuttling and shucking in a bowl of not-quite-solidified jello. Saliva squirted into his mouth, bitter and tangy as the chlorophyll in a waxy leaf. He felt faint with fear. His stomach flooded with cold lead as his testicles drew up into his abdomen. Get out of here now! It wasn't his mother anymore. This was the lizard brain speaking, the cold voice of survival. He went jelly-legged. The bones felt as if they'd been reduced to marrow soup. Pure fear invaded his mind, creating a carnival of terrifying images. Visions of clean-picked skulls and empty sockets, huge white worms barreling out of inflamed tunnels like hellish bullet trains, long, tube-like hands slipping from the shadows, reaching for... A shuddering groan escaped Newton. He put his hand over his face and stumbled back. His ass hit the cabin wall, and he yelped in surprise.
Newton? Max called out anxiously. You okay?
Newton swallowed with difficulty. It was so good to hear Max's voice, to remember that the world was bigger than this cabin with its collapsing angles and alien sounds that made Newton's skin scream.
I'm okay. Just stay outside. Be out in a sec.
Newton realized that he could just get the hell out. It was one of the perks of being a kid, wasn't it? Kids could abandon anything at any time with no real repercussions. Except there were no adults around anymore, and he had work to do. He edged down the wall into the bedroom. There, his books were on the far side. A sleeping bag lay 5 feet beyond his right foot. He hunkered down and crab-crawled toward it. He heard those distant popgun pops, and imagined those weightless ribbons surging through the air toward him. He crawled faster, a desperate moan swelling in his chest. He reached the sleeping bag and pulled it over him. Just before he did, he saw the air above him shimmering with luminous squiggles. He lay under the bag, inhaling the scent of its owner, stale sweat and pine sap and illicitly smoked cigarettes, so it must have been Eve's. Newton rose with the bag tucked over his head. He oriented himself, swallowed his fear. A plumb stone lodged in his throat and shuffled toward the closet with the bag held up like a shield. The squirming was very loud now, even through the cloth of the bag. It sounded eager and agitated at once. Even though his heart was beating hard enough to shudder every bone in his body and adrenaline-rich sweat was dumping out of every pore, Newton advanced patiently and cautiously. God, somehow the worms were still alive, still firing off their fusillade. Newton figured they must be spores or eggs or something, a way for the worms to infect you from far away. On the peripheries of his vision, he could see the odd ribbon go floating past. Don't breathe them in. Don't breathe in at all. Get out of here now, 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 now! His toes hit the edge of the collapsed closet. The tip of Scoutmaster Tim's index finger lay beside his right foot. He flung down the sleeping bag and backpedaled madly as it settled over the Scoutmaster's body. The were muffled by the bag. The scoutmaster's arm jutted from beneath it, frozen at an unnatural angle, fingers like craggly bits of driftwood washed up on the beach. Newton hustled over to his knapsack and made sure the nylon rope was still inside. His field book was a little water-fattened after the downpour, but still legible. He quickly checked to see if any of the ribbons had gotten on anything. No, he was clean. He stuffed the book in his knapsack, gave everything a final once-over, and hightailed it outside. News item from the Montague PEI Island Courier, October 22nd. Men arrested after breaching military's quarantine zone. Two men were placed under arrest following an incident that occurred several miles off the northern coast of North Point. Reginald Kirkwood, 45, and Jeffrey Jenks, 43, both of Lower Montague County, were taken into custody by military police officers shortly after 10 a.m. this morning. Both were charged with grand larceny and direct contravention of a state of emergency order. The former charge carries a minimum sentence of 5 years under the Canadian Criminal Charter. According to eyewitness accounts, Jenks, the town's police chief, and Kirkwood, its county coroner, stole a boat belonging to Mr. Calvin Walmack. Mr. Jenks piloted the boat across the 3-mile stretch separating the mainland from Falstaff Island, which remains under quarantine due to the potential presence of an unknown biological threat. Exact details remain undisclosed, but available evidence suggests their boat experienced mechanical difficulties that hindered their progress. The boat was chased down by a pair of military patrol boats, and both men were taken into custody. Due to the proximity to the island and the potential for biological transfection, the boat was scuttled using an incendiary device. The arrestees are the fathers of Kent Jenks and Maximilian Kirkwood, members of Scout Troop 52, which also includes Shelley Longpre, Newton Thornton, and Ephraim Elliott, all 14 years of age. They were accompanied to Falstaff Island by their scoutmaster, Tim Riggs, 42, North Point's resident MD, last Friday evening for a weekend field trip. They have been isolated on Falstaff Island since the quarantine zone was established. Calls to the military attaché's office went unreturned as of press time. Chapter 26. They set out just after noon. Three boys, Max, Ephraim, and Newton. Max checked on Kent beforehand, still huddled in the cellar under the tarp. His body looked like it was vanishing into the cellar wall, oozing into the hard-packed earth, as if the wall had grown a mouth and was consuming Kent the way a spider eats a fly, injecting corrosive poison, dissolving the guts, and sucking them out with a long, needle-like proboscis. "We'll be back soon," Max told him. He stood on the final step before the cellar floor, keeping his distance. "We'll find something to make you better, okay?" Kent said nothing, just watched with eyes hard and dry as pebbles. Shelley was missing. They called his name a few times, half-heartedly. No response. "Should we go anyways?" Newton said. "Why shouldn't we?" said Ephraim. If the boys felt a vague uneasiness over Shelley's whereabouts, more and more it seemed best to keep him in plain sight. His disappearance gave them an easy excuse to leave without him. What harm could it bring? Maybe he really did walk into the sea, Newton thought, not unhopefully, then quickly chastised himself for it. Newton took the lead. Max and Ephraim didn't question this. After seeing him emerge from the cabin, sweaty and near delirious with fear, his knapsack slung triumphantly over his shoulder, it was hard not to measure him a little differently. The afternoon was bright but cool. Most of their clothing was inside the cabin, damp and unwearable. Ephraim had a windbreaker. Newton had only one dry shirt. They walked along the southern skirt of the island, following the shore. Strands of kelp washed up on the rocks, looking like disembodied green hands clawing their way out of the sea. Ephraim peeled a strand and looked questioningly at Newton.
"Yeah, it's edible, Eph."
Ephraim nibbled an edge.
"Holy crap, Newt." "I said it was edible," Newton said. "I didn't say it was any good."
Max peeled a strip off a flat rock.
"Hey, it's not bad," he said, chewing. "Salty. Like beef jerky from the sea."
Ephraim took another crackly bite and chewed morosely.
"Whatever, I'm hungry enough to eat a bear's asshole."
Soon after saying this, Ephraim lapsed into a moody silence.
He kept rubbing his knuckles on his pants. "You okay, man?" Max said. He put a hand on his shoulder. Ephraim shivered as if a spider had crawled down his back. At first, Max thought it was because of what happened outside the cellar, that awful snap between them, something Max had felt to his core. But that wasn't it, was it? A cold species of relief washed over Max, only to be replaced with dread. Was Eph? Max gave Newton a worried look as his hand slid off Ephraim's shoulder. "Feeling real weird, man." Ephraim's voice sounded like it was coming from the bottom of a well. "I'm not really feeling like myself." "Yeah, none of us are," Max assured him. "Max is right, Eph. With what happened to Scoutmaster and now Kent, we just got to hold it together a little while longer is all." Ephraim gave Newton a bemused and slightly shaken look. "Newton Thornton, professional pep talker," he said bleakly. They climbed a hillside that crested to a flat rise studded with boulders and hardy tufted shrubs. The air was perfumed by the salt wind that gusted across the table rock. The ground was pockmarked with holes. Each hole was dug down to a tight gooseneck bend that obscured its occupants from view. "Prairie dogs?" Max asked. "Are we on a prairie?" said Ephraim. "Where are the cowboys, Tex?" "Shut up," Max said irritably. "Cowboys aren't all on the prairies anyway." Ephraim laughed and scratched his elbows. He'd scratched through his windbreaker. Max noticed blood dotting the torn nylon. "Not prairie dogs," said Newton. "Birds. I've read about them. Instead of making nests in trees, they burrow underground." Max said, "Can we catch one?" Newton looked doubtful. "I've never seen a rope trap for birds. You need box traps for those with chicken wire. I don't think it'd be worth it. They're pretty much just bones and feathers, right?" Max thought about those dead shearwaters on his kitchen table and said, "Let's not bother, okay? Whatever we do eat out here, you can bet it's going to be a bit weird," Newton said. "We ought to be prepared for that." He smiled gamely. "Just think of it all like chicken or something." They crossed the plateau to a granite shelf overlooking the sea. The clean mineral smell of the rock hit their noses. Sunlight filled in the slack water between the waves in mellow gold. White ospreys took flight from their cliffside nests, arcing over the water. Ephraim kicked a stone over the edge. It clattered down the cliff and nearly crushed an osprey nest sitting on a jagged outcrop. Ephraim pointed at the trio of brown-specked eggs in the nest and said, "You want to climb down for those? I could go for a 3-egg omelet." Newton looked dubious. "There's nowhere to tie the rope. If you slip, it's a long way down." Ephraim picked his tongue along his upper teeth, still considering it. "I'd have to share the eggs with your fat ass, Newton, wouldn't I? I do all the work and you horn in on the reward." "You can have them," Newton said stiffly. "I just don't think it's worth getting hurt over." With the prospect of eggs fading, they wandered down a switchback descent that emptied into a salt marsh to the east of the cliff. The ocean water leached into a mucky terrain of buckled trees and diseased-looking hummocks. A rotten stench boiled up from the long grass, which was exactly the sort of grass Newton hated, the serrated, edged kind that raked your shins when you walked through it in shorts. They trudged through, trying to avoid soakers. Their boots cracked through skeins of crusted, bile-colored salt that looked like the scum topping a pot of boiled meat. Late-season grasshoppers flung themselves off the grass and stuck to the boys' clothes with their barbed legs. Newton flinched every time one pinged off his hips. His gaze kept drifting to those hummocks. They looked like half-submerged rodents, giant mole rats suckled on plutonium-enriched water that had somehow quadrupled their normal size. They dotted the marsh like hairy icebergs, the worst parts hidden underwater. Newton pictured what might lurk below the surface, long, narrow faces and thin black lips studded with sharp rat teeth that protruded at busted glass angles, ringed pink tails sweeping through the filthy water, waiting to wrap around an unsuspecting ankle. They came upon a rotted tree stump. Newton dug his field book out, riffled through the pages, and skimmed a passage. He grabbed a flap of bark hanging loosely from the stump and pried it back. It snapped off with a puff of dust. The boys knelt and stared inside. Things wriggled in the loose wood pulp. They wriggled just like worms. Grubs, Newton announced. He opened his book and read, Witchetty grubs are the large, white, wood-eating larvae of moths. The grubs were a speckled white with a wrinkled exterior that resembled the skin of an apple that had sat in the fruit bowl too long. Their bodies were as big as a toddler's finger and crimped like beads on a necklace. Their back ends tapered to a pooched orifice,